This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A book that is entitled The Gary Anthology is, in the best description I could give right now, is of what the introduction written by the author of the book is. It says, this is an anthology for a city written off as dead, or at best dying, by most commentators. We're talking about, of course, the city of Gary. The book is entitled The Gary Anthology. It's edited by our guest today, Sam Love, and it's available if you would like a copy of it from Belt Publishing. And Sam Love, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Hey, Chris, it's great to talk with you again.
It's nice to talk with you, too. The last time we talked is, interestingly enough, one of the topics that's mentioned in the book, talking about decay devils and other ways that a lot of activists, at least in the last 5 to 10 years, have been doing their best to help bring life back to the city of Gary. But, of course, it goes back way beyond that, into the history of Gary, and this book kind of touches that, only from a different angle. Tell us about the idea of coming up with an anthology with so many people's hands in the mix, so to speak.
Well, you know, that part is a continuation of what my practice as a social and civic practice artist has been, which is to create platforms by which communities can, you know, express themselves and their views of the places that they live. Now, the anthology, it's part of Belt Publishing City Anthology series.
Mm-hmm.
This started back in 2013, and it's covering these Rust Belt, Midwestern, and Appalachian cities, because in publishing, so much is based on the coast, particularly New York, so they call it flyover country, right? There's all these layers of misunderstanding and whatnot. So this is an opportunity for those of us in the Midwest or Appalachia to highlight the quality of writing that we have and tell our stories. So I was very excited when Belt put out a call for the Gary Anthology, and within about a day or two of answering that, I had a book contract, so here we are now.
How long did it take you to get all these authors together to tell their stories that you could compile into this book?
Well, we started the process in March 2019, and the book is formally releasing on September 15th, but if you go to beltpublishing.com and pre-order it, you'll get it before it's officially released. It's mm-hmm. already back from the printer and shipping. But really, it was about 10 weeks. From about Halloween to New Year's, that's when I did the meat of the work. That's when most of the articles came in. But it was, you know, it was a longer process and then a short period of really intense work that I really enjoyed doing, by the way.
Well, this is a very interesting read. As like many anthologies, it's broken up differently than a solid read that is you sit and read for as long as you want to and then put your bookmark in and come back to it later. You'll want to sit and look through this. And this is broken up into sections based around some topics and some, I guess, some thoughts that people had. I'm going to go through the topics that are brought up in sections. They have them in different sections. For example, one section is entitled A Family and Legends. And there's one article in particular that Marie Sroki talked about. She's a very interesting person, I'm sure, in her own right. And she wrote something which is entitled Seeing Through the Window of Time. Tell us a little bit about that particular bit of the anthology she put in.
Well, I could tell you first that that's the second story in the book, and it follows Dina Hall and Neil because they're best friends. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that their articles were next to each other.
That's good.
But
okay.
They do kind of touch on each other a little bit. And in Marie, I don't want to give away too much of it because, you know, it's such a wonderful thing to read and discover for yourself. But the coincidence and the connections over time are just so profound. And I love her last sentence. I will read that.
Okay.
This is Gary, where generations share and connect by simply being present, where our buildings are our soul and we rekindle one another when we least expect it. That's what her story really is. And it really is a moving one. So thank you, Marie, for getting me a story and being in this anthology.
Now, we started out our conversation talking about the fact this is a number of different types of writings put together. Poetry is one of them. There's a section on Gary poetry. And Lydia Johnson kind of gets to the near the end of the area and entitled her pieces, I Am From Gary, Indiana. Tell us a little bit more about that one.
You know, I love how you're asking this because I've been playing a game with people when we talk about the anthology, which is pick a random article and I'll tell you what I love about it because
yeah.
I love every single piece in here. And hers is just great place-based poetry because she gets into the behaviors that one would see if one got to know Gary, Indiana. And although it's not really explicit, what so many people say about Gary who know Gary, and I totally agree with this, and I probably said this before in our conversations, it's like a big southern village. That's the flavor up here. And she gets into the details of that in her poem, some of these behaviors you would see, family dinners and life on the block and things like that. So personally, I love that kind of poetry. That was what we were doing with the Gary Poetry Project and what I did with Lockport and Carroll County Poetry Projects, just get people to write about the places where they're from. They're the experts on this. You know, they know better than any journalist from the coast.
I know there's also another article in the section that is entitled Stories of the Land and Environment that is very interesting. Maybe people have actually done it, but if they've maybe done it in their minds, or maybe they've had the opportunity to be able to do it by just driving in the car along this particular route. But the article that Michael McCauley has in here, which is called Walking the Divided Coast, Gary to Miller Beach. And you have to just about really and truly do it to see the stark differences between neighborhoods in the community of Gary, isn't it?
Yeah, and Michael was somebody I didn't know before the anthology came together. I do have to say I know most of the authors in here, but I was so pleased to get to know him. And this is an excerpt from a book that's going to be published by Northwestern University. We're not sure when, but I'm so honored that Michael sent me a draft and was so eager to be included in this book. He actually was in Gary about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he'll be around doing some research for updates on this manuscript before it gets published. But yeah, he walked from Chicago all the way to Gary, and it is quite a journey, and he's an excellent writer.
Yeah, that's what I particularly liked about that. There's some very, very stark and very sad, or they seem sad, maybe, because you're so used to wanting to see everything that is good and positive. But that's not always the case. Life isn't like that, and in particular this way, too. Oh, by the way, we're talking with Sam Love. He's the editor of what is called the Gary Anthology. It's a book that is coming out soon by Belt Publishing. You can get a copy from the publisher and find out more. In talking about the city of Gary, you not only have to talk about the starkness because how things happened, how the economic decline of the city occurred, what people see when they travel through the community every day, but there's also some great history in here. In particular, one article that's in the Round Town section of the book by Nicole Palaska, which is entitled The 1972 National Black Political Convention in Gary. That's just a bit of history people maybe don't even know about.
Oh, correct. And, Nicole Poltika, who is with the Indiana Historical Bureau, and I'm very grateful to them for allowing us to republish. This was published online, but I felt it needed to be in print because I do know that there are a dearth of sources about that convention, and so I wanted to contribute to that body of work and make sure that this is in print. Hers is kind of a different story than everyone else's, because hers is the only one where she doesn't really make clear what her relationship to Gary is. She's not a part of this story. It's more of an academic-type piece, whereas everyone else, either explicitly or implicitly, dwells on their connection to this city. But it was so important to get that on there. So I was very happy to have that. And a film, Nation Time Gary, the Gary International Black Film Festival, just debuted that recently online, and I encourage everybody to go check that out. When I was in graduate school, I knew young black scholars who wanted to research the history of this convention and its deeper meaning, but there was a lack of sources, so the gatekeepers wouldn't allow them to do this vital research. So I'm proud to have Nicole's piece in here, and Dina Holland-Neal, our opener, she talks about what it was like to be at that convention as a 17-year-old. So grateful to both of them, and hopefully a lot of great scholarship and inquiry will flourish from this literary project.
One final note I'd like you to bring up, if you will, Sam, that's in the Gary Anthology. It's a long one. It's one of the longer ones that's in here. It's entitled The Journey Home. Ryan Fleming is the fellow who wrote this. He took a bit of his own life in coming from a rural part of Indiana into Northwest Indiana, and how it, no doubt, he had experienced a lot as growing up, from not only from being away from home into a strange area, different from what he was used to, but in turn he was able to grow into the area and how he became part of Gary, Indiana eventually.
Yeah, Ryan, DJ Rhino, as we know him, is a great buddy of mine. I think we've been friends for maybe 15 years or something like that now, and he is definitely a vital part of the community out here. And I love his story because it covers so much ground. One of the goals I had with the anthology was to make sure that if I could make a map of where all these stories are taking place, it would resemble the borders of Gary. You know, it wouldn't just be focused on downtown or Miller or IUN. So I did achieve that, I feel. Didn't get every little community in the city represented, maybe next time around. But Ryan's story really does take us on a tour around all of Gary, Indiana. And I think it's his attitude about how he's learned and what he's learned from being here and how he's taken his observations and put it into action. And it's just a great story. I mean, here's a man, he's the lead pastor at the Revolution Church, but there's an awful lot of civil disobedience coming up in his story. So I, even though I've known him for a while, I feel like I got to know him better and say, yeah, this is a cool dude, you know?
Well, and we can't pass up finding out something more to someone who's not familiar with the Decay Devils. In fact, there is a particular part of the anthology that is written by somebody very close to the topic. Tell us more about what Tyrell has this to say. And we should mention, too, that he has another book of his own coming out as well. But that's aside from this. We're talking about the Gary anthology right now.
Well, actually, I can give you a little scoop. Tyrell and I are going to be doing a joint book signing at the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District on Lake Street in Miller on Saturday, September 26th, 6 to 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
We're just getting those details hammered out now, but we're really excited to be working together. And we have another little project I'm not going to say too much about right now.
But okay, yeah, don't.
If we do it, you'll know about it. But yeah, Tyrell closes our book, and he's in a section called Now and Next, The Future of Gary, Indiana. And with this section was actually a little different. Most of these were audio recordings. I sat down and took testimonials. They weren't really interviews because I tried not to ask questions. The folks who contributed had something to say and just didn't necessarily have the time to sit down and type all that out and do re-edits and whatnot. So these were taken kind of my homage to one of my good friends and history mentors, Jim Lane of IUN, mm-hmm. who is a professor of mine and taught me so much about oral history and social history and history from the bottom up. So yeah, Tyrell, I mean, his story's all over. If you Google his name and Decay Devils, it's all kinds of stories come up, and so many people have paid attention to the work they're doing. So I was glad to get a personal story from him. And, you know, I've worked with him and them for a couple of years now, but I feel like I learned more about how they developed as a group from just some folks wandering around abandoned buildings in Gary, like I used to do, admittedly, into a force for preservation here and a force for arts and a force for community. So it's a personal story of what this organization's been doing.
The Gary Anthology is the title of the book, and the editor for the book is Sam Love, who we've just been talking to here. And the book is published by Belt Publishing, and you can get a copy from the publisher. And as what Sam had mentioned, there'll be a book signing coming up here very soon in September. Check that out as well, too, online and find out more about that. And Sam, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the Gary Anthology. It's a great reading, and you'll want to get a copy to be able to check it out and learn more, not only if you're not a resident of Gary or a resident of Lake County, for that matter, but you'll just want to find out more about the city that hasn't died. It's still very much alive.
Very much alive. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I was born and raised in Gary, Indiana. I grew up on the west side of town on Clinton Street, two blocks from Westside High School. You know, when I left the house that morning, I was at the school the entire day. I went to school at 7 in the morning because I was an ROTC gym team member, and I was a commander as my senior year. So I was there at 7 o'clock for drill team practice, left from there, go to class. After class, during football season, football practice. Then after football practice, I went to karate class. So by the time I got home, it was like 7:30 o'clock. So I did get home in time, was to do homework, my chores, which was wash dishes, or if it's my brother's week, he'd wash dishes and I would clean up the basement. Now over the summer, you're up, you went around the neighborhood, you played sports, rode your bike. It was safe to ride your bike back then. But when them street lights came on, you had to be in the house or you had to be anywhere in distance where you can hear your mother calling you. That's the thing. We didn't have cell phones and all that back then. You had to listen to your voice or your mom, because you could be blocks away and you hear your name. And you knew that was the time that, hey, I need to get home. And your friends did too. So you could see us all flying home on our bikes, because we knew if the streetlights come on, we had to be in the house. When I came through, you had all five schools. You had Westside, Horseman, Work, the Wallace, and Roosevelt. And each of them had a ROTC program. Each year in March, we would have the citywide competition. And the whole city is inside Westside Gym. I mean, it's from the floor all the way up to the ceilings on the second floor is how it used to be. Like the Super Bowl for high school, who has the bragging rights, so we call it the number one drill team in the city. As the schools close and as the program withered away, it's not as a big deal like it used to be. We had recreation every summer. We had arts and craft at one point, learned geography at another class area. We had basketball. We had all kind of other stuff to do during the summer. And we ate lunch there amongst each other. Parents was working 8 to 4. So between the first hour they're gone, we're at home. The last hour before they come home, we're back at home. But they know those 6 hours, hey, they had recreation. And we had people who lived in the neighborhood, might have worked evenings or nights, that kept an eye on us. Hey, I got your son. He's here at my house. Don't have to worry about nothing. We was disciplined by everyone. You know, we just couldn't just say, well, my mom this, my mom that. Now, if I did it with my neighbor, then that neighbor parent got a chance to correct both of us if we was wrong. And then my mother would say that too. If you did it with them, then you deserve the punishment with them. That's just how it was done back then when I grew up, because it takes everybody to teach someone how to be. It's just not just one person or that one family. It's your neighborhood that you grew up, that you respected. That's where it comes from, like the village raising each other, because we had the aspect of being safe. We had to worry about, okay, if we go next door, this gonna happen or that gonna happen. We believed in everybody and they believed in us and they helped raise us. As we done got older as adults, we have forgotten where we came from. In order to make our kids better, we had to provide these things for them. But a lot of us have moved on and moved away, so we're taking them things to other areas. I see a lot lacking. It's because no one wants to come here and put in the work or the effort or the money into this for some reason. I don't know why, but I mean, if I'd had the chance, I would, because we have a lot of kids who don't know that we had Beatty basketball everywhere, who don't know we had Little League baseball here and there, who don't know that we had 3-4 Pop Warner teams. It gave us, as we were growing up, something to do besides standing in the streets, hanging on the corner, or at home just playing Xbox or PlayStation all the time. We had something to do.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, the 104th running of the greatest spectacle in racing is now history. In more ways than one, the Indianapolis 500-mile race was run this past weekend, and it is, described, I suppose, by some and maybe many as the most unique race they've probably ever known of yet. And IMS historian Donald Davidson, who was with us not long ago to talk about one of the aspects of the Indy 500 in the past, is with us again. And what are your thoughts, Donald? Because you're a historian, you really think about this most unique race yet.
Oh, what are my thoughts? Oh, my goodness me. I don't know what anybody really has in the way of thoughts, but it just was surreal to run on August the 23rd. It had never gone later than May the 31st ever.
Mm-hmm.
It was not run 6 times, but that was during World War One and Two, and since that time, now with the first 103 runnings, no matter when, you know, rain delays or whatever it was, it always, there was a winner declared by May the 31st. So to have it on August the 23rd and with nobody in the stands, it just was really strange, I think, probably for everybody that was there. But the fact that it was on TV and radio, you know, it was an interesting race. It's something that, you know, a lot of people had hard times with because they had their streak broken. The people that that say, oh, you know, I've went 42 years in a row, or 57, or, you know, 68 in a row, because, which a lot of people can claim, certainly, you know, 40 to 45 is probably about average. And so what I'm saying, well, look, you know what, this will be a memory, and when next May, at the end of May, it'll be on the traditional date, hopefully, and then you'll be able to say from that point, I've been to every 500 in May since, you know, 1961 or whatever mm-hmm. it is. But it's in the books now. The weather forecast kept changing. Apparently it was going to rain. It didn't. And it's now it's over and we have a winner. But certainly a very, very strange experience for everybody.
Now, I know that typically they'll have 300,000 people show up at the Speedway to fill the stands and the what used to be the snake pit, or just the area that's outside of the track itself. And only a few thousand showed up this time around, obviously because you had to hang outside the gates, basically. From what you've heard and listened to and talked to people about, what would that be like to be out there hanging outside the building and hearing the sound of the cars go by but not seeing anybody?
It's just, you know, the local TV covered that and talked to a lot of those people. And I know personally some that came from out of state to just come here and then be across the way in a just a lawn chair or whatever it is, just to hear the sounds and get a little glimpse of the cars. And then they were able to see one of the Jumbotron television screens, but it just was there's just no way to describe it. And hopefully we never have to do anything like this again. It's not anything I enjoy talking about, but I think a number of people we got our wish. We thought, you know what, hopefully whoever wins will be a repeat winner, because they have already experienced the joy of doing it in front of the crowd, which is so much a part of it, and how sad it would have been for somebody to win for the first time, and maybe that be their only victory, and have it happen with nobody in the stands. I mean, even on the first qualifying, on the qualifications when Marco Andretti won the pole, which was a hugely emotional time, and there was nobody in the stands, it would have been, you know, so great to have an ovation. So the fact that Takuma Sato is a repeat winner, he won it in 2017 in front of a big crowd, and so he has had that experience. So I think that was a good thing. So he's an international winner and very popular in Japan, and so, I mean, you know, the end result was good. It just was just strange circumstances under which it had to be conducted.
Let me ask, what was it like to actually get to see it on television, since they've had the blackout for so many years, and they had to lift the blackout basically in the Indianapolis area because of the fact that nobody could personally attend the race?
Well, it was available this time, so you know, you could watch it on TV, and I will turn the TV sound down and have the radio broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
So that was at least available. And I think they did everything. I think management did everything possible to recognize, you know, the people that had come, whether it was from just down the street or a state or two or three away, to be outside. And I don't know if there were any visits. I mean, during qualifying, Doug Bowles, who's the president of Indianapolis Speedway, he went out onto the street, I think, at least once and maybe a second time, just to interact with the fans, because, you know, he was raised in the sport and he's a fan. So I think they did everything possible to, you know, make the locals feel a part of it. In fact, after they did the drivers' meeting was a little bit different, because there was nobody in attendance other than the drivers and just, you know, maybe a half a dozen of the staff. And when the drivers' meeting was completed and the drivers all sat, you know, quite a distance from each other on either side and front and back, and they put all 33 of them in pace cars and then drove them down Main Street Speedway, and then they each went to longtime ticket buyers that had been designated and showed up just by surprise. And here's somebody sitting in their front yard, and here comes Elio Castroneves to thank them for their support.
Well, there's always next year, but let's hope that there's never another next year like this year has been, to be sure.
Hopefully we'll be back running at the end of May, and it'll be like what everybody has loved and cherished for much of their lives.
Donald Davidson is historian for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and thank you, Donald, for your thoughts on this 2020 Indianapolis 500-mile race that was run without spectators, the first and hopefully the last of its kind.
Thank you. Yes, indeed.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This past weekend, the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, or better known as MAC, had a chance to once again honor the first responders of our region, who they have many times have in training there at the center in Valparaiso. But this past weekend was a very special First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day. And with us to talk about it, we have the lady who is in charge of the McMillan Family Foundation, Selena Weatherwax. They're the people that head up the MAC operation. And Selena, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Tell us first, for folks that are not necessarily familiar with MAC, the Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, what it is.
The Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative, or the MAC as we've come to affectionately refer to it as, is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to meeting the training needs of our local first responders. And our campus has been developed and constructed to support firefighters, police officers, and EMS personnel. So we're the first comprehensive training center in the state of Indiana, and given the fact that we are a nonprofit, we're constantly looking at ways to bring community and first responders together, and Saturday's event was just a little reminder of what that's all about.
I suppose for those who are not familiar with the organization, they're probably, of course, familiar with the fact that firefighters need training, especially if they're new firefighters coming on the job at, say, a municipal fire department or even a volunteer fire department, especially. They need to be trained somehow or another. They're not quite like police officers where they get to go to the big academy in Indianapolis for formal training, but they need to be trained just the same. And that's what, in this particular case, that's what the MAC Center is really all about, isn't it?
That's correct. We train both the career and volunteer firefighters here. The career track is a much faster track because those men and women go through the academy here at the MAC Monday through Friday, whereas the volunteer cadets come to the MAC and pursue their academy requirements Tuesday, Thursday nights from about 6 to 10, and then all day Saturdays. So their academy is extended throughout a six-month process versus the 9 or 10 weeks that the career folks do. So it's a blend of all volunteer career. And we also have a high school program. These high school kids come throughout the entire school year as part of their vocational training. And so they're also here Monday through Friday in the afternoon during the school day. And upon completion of their requirements, they become full-fledged certified firefighters as well.
That's great. Now, this past weekend, this First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day was a chance, I guess, to show the place off to people that maybe have never seen it before, but they also had a chance to really experience something that nobody around here's had since the Gary Ayer Show had to stop performances, and that's the Lima Lima Flight Team. Tell us what they are and what they did this past weekend.
So the Lima Lima Flight Team is headquartered out of Naperville, although the pilots that were part of the demonstration on Saturday came from all throughout the country. Mm-hmm. There were four of them, and these are aerobatic pilots, so many of them have been trained within our armed forces. But the folks here that were here on Saturday did two, quote-unquote, flight demos to honor first responders. And they did so in conjunction with the plane of TAPS and also led with a missing man formation, or ended, excuse me, with a missing man formation.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that, as you mentioned, as part of the training, they get to be able to, people get to be able to work the equipment and the like, but this was a real chance, I guess, for the average person to see, first off, what first responders do other than when they hear the sirens go by and they hear a fire truck or an ambulance go by, and they may see that, but they actually get to see these people at work. And you had a number, I guess, of police and fire agencies that came by to show off this past weekend.
That's exactly it. We had nearly 20 different agencies that were involved, heavy presence from both fire and police side. And because of it, the community became, I think, better educated, or at least increased their awareness in terms of what these men and women, these courageous men and women, have to go through in order to be ready to protect and serve our communities. The training that they participate in is ongoing. Lots of emphasis on the law enforcement side has been put on de-escalation and use of force training, more community policing. On the fire side, the ongoing safety precautions that need to be taken place. On the EMS side, also same, especially given the COVID pandemic. So a blend of all these organizations showing off what they do to be prepared for when that call comes in is what took place on Saturday, in addition to the Lima flight team doing their flight demonstration.
Now, have they had to retool in many cases because of the pandemic? It's just gotten more stressful, certainly, because of what they normally do, but then they've got the COVID-19 on top of that.
That's exactly it. So there's a lot of other additional safety precautions that they have to take into account now. So we had also presence here from in-house ambulance service, who was doing some antibody testing. But nevertheless, the whole point was to bring community and first responders together under one roof, and that's what we accomplished on Saturday. Most of the activities, if not all, were outside. And that was very deliberately planned because of the different COVID precautions that we needed to take as a planning committee, too.
Well, it sounds like that not only first responders, but members of the public had a chance to enjoy some activities, something a little different because of the pandemic, but certainly very important to learn what the first responders are really doing these days to help save lives and property. And, Selena, thank you for talking about this past weekend's event.
Thank you, Chris. Take care. I hope to connect with you soon. Thank you.
Selena Weatherwax is with the McMillan Family Foundation. They, of course, have established the MAC Foundation that helps better serve all public safety professionals here in Northwest Indiana and across the state. This is Regionally Speaking. Coming up tomorrow, Wednesday, August 26th, is the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment that is taking place. And here in Indiana, the Indiana Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission has a couple very interesting live-streamed events that you should know about. And with us to talk about it, we have Leah Namias. She's the Director of Programs for Indiana Humanities. And Leah, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a moment first, talk about the importance of this 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment and what Indiana's Lieutenant Governor, who is the head of the commission, has set up here that you'll have a chance to take part of coming up on Wednesday.
Tomorrow marks the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment going into effect. We're really excited that it's been 100 years since women in Indiana and around the nation have had the right to vote. So there are things happening all over the place, and if you are on social media or reading or listening to the news, I'm sure you'll learn a lot about suffrage. In Indiana, we're going to be two cool announcements that people can tune into on Facebook. In the morning at 10 a.m. Eastern, we'll be announcing the three recipients of the Preserving Women's Legacy grants. These are a special grant to permanently commemorate the contributions of Indiana women. So three communities are going to be announced and their projects, and there is one in Northwest Indiana, so I hope your listeners will tune in to see that announcement with Lieutenant Governor. And then later in the day at 1 o'clock Eastern, two new permanent artworks that will be installed at the Indiana State House commemorating the centennial of suffrage by women artists in Indiana will be unveiled. So that was a collaboration between the Indiana Arts Commission and the Suffrage Commission. The Preserving Women's Legacy grants are a collaboration between the commission, the Indiana Humanities and the Indiana Office of Community and Rural Affairs.
I know the original artworks unveiling, which is coming up tomorrow at 1 o'clock, involves not only the Suffrage Centennial Commission, but also the Arts Commission. Have a couple very important artists that are involved in this. Tell us a little bit about the two artists and the works that they're going to be showing off as part of the live stream on Wednesday.
One of the artists is creating artwork, a very traditional feminine women's kind of craft. So she's really inspired by the history of women in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So she's doing a really cool combination of printmaking and quilt making. So she's doing these, I've seen these photos of her incredible screen prints of portraits of Indiana suffragists. So some of whom are really well known, like Grace Julian Clark and May Wright Sewell, and some of whom are lesser well known, like Carrie Barnes Ross. So she's doing that, and then she's kind of creating this multimedia quilt piece that commemorates some of the suffragists from Indiana. And then the other piece is a more traditional painting. The woman who's creating that piece is a muralist by training, so it kind of has the scale as you kind of imagine, like the kind of old murals that you might see in a post office or something like that.
Uh-huh.
She's kind of working in that tradition, and it depicts women going to cast their ballots for the first time in 1920.
Now, Leah, tell us where people, if they want to go onto onto Facebook to see these, which site will they look for, and the times that these two live streaming events are going to happen?
Well, you can head to the Indiana Women's Suffrage Centennial Facebook page. So if you go to IndianaSuffrage100.org, you can find all the links to all the different social media accounts as well as more information about both of these projects. So those pages are where you can find things on the Facebook page. At 10 a.m. is the announcement about the Preserving Women's Legacy Grant, and 1 p.m. is the unveiling of these new artworks that'll be at the State House.
Leah Namias is the Director of Programs for Indiana Humanities. Again, Facebook live streaming of the Women's Legacy Grants announcement. It's going to be at 10 a.m. and the 1 o'clock unveiling of the original artworks that you can also catch on the Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission's Facebook page. And Leah, thank you for giving us the update, and we hope many people here in Northwest Indiana take advantage of seeing this and find out more about the Women's Legacy Grant announcement tomorrow.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.